And we have people there that just would like to be in a more home-like setting, but they don't have caregivers that can do that at home. A well-known statistic is that most people say they want to die at home. In our country, only about 20% of people are actually able to do that. We have elderly couples where their children may be in Alaska, California, stationed in Afghanistan, and one of them is dying, and the other person can't possibly do that round-the-clock caregiving that's required. That's a very common scenario. As a frail elder that requires enough care, there may be six family members at the bedside while they're in the hospital, but these are people that are coming after work. They can't afford to give up their jobs. They're not paid when they take family medical leave. So these are our community members that we just really can't support in the home. There just aren't the financial resources. We have instances where a younger parent may be dying. Frequently, perhaps not frequently, but there are people that say, I don't want my family to always associate their home with my final moments. I think they don't realize that that's usually okay and that families do well in that situation. I've had young families say, we've just moved into our new home. I don't want this to be the place where I pass with my young children here. I would rather go somewhere outside of that setting. We also have indigent people in our community, and many of these are productive citizens that have worked for years supporting all of us in one industry or another. They've run out of funds. They can't hire caregiving in the home. And by default, those people end up dying in a hospital. We have occasional people that say, I'm comfortable in the hospital. This is where I feel safest. And certainly that's fine. But the vast majority of people would rather be somewhere else.
In this last part of the program, I'm wondering, thinking about the broader community and putting yourself in the place of folks in the local community, government, possible supporters, possible donors, what will they be thinking to themselves as they hear about the Sojourn Center, do you think?
I think one question people will have is, encourage people to move away from hospice care in the home? And I think that is not the goal of Sojourn Center. For many families, hospice care at home is the ideal. I know in my own personal situation, both my parents wanted to die at home, and I wanted them to die at home and to be with them, and it was very workable for us because I was able to help them as both a daughter and as a healthcare provider. It was wonderful, but that is not available to everyone. I know there was a recent death of my mother-in-law, and the family decided that there was a discomfort between the siblings of my husband, and could they really do this? You know, there was just that, like Tina was describing, a little bit of a fear of trying to do home hospice care. They didn't have confidence, even though I was willing to be a part of that. It was their decision, and they just couldn't quite feel comfortable doing home care, even though they wanted to. A Sojourn Center would have been an ideal alternative in that situation. So we're not trying to move people away from home hospice care. We're trying to give another alternative care situation for many people that it just does not work for them to do home hospice.
As we look at Sojourn Center and the development of it as an organization, tell us about some of the work that that you've accomplished so far, and where are you currently as an organization for our listeners. And just a reminder to our listeners, our phone lines are open, and you're welcome to call and ask questions or share observations about end-of-life care. Our number here is 230-9888, 230-9888. So anyway, and if you would.
Well, to try and put our 4 years of work into a couple minutes, I don't know if I could do that, but a major accomplishment was working with two local attorneys who volunteered to help us with the requirements, articles of incorporation, and receive our tax-exempt status. That was a huge accomplishment for our organization. And creating a board and an extensive group of advisors. We had a recent strategic planning workshop about a week ago where 24 people enthusiastically gathered in support and planning for upcoming goals and objectives related to Sojourn Center. We have a land acquisition team, a group of four people that are actively looking for land. We're looking for probably 5 to 10 acres of land, preferably donated or at reduced cost. So any listeners who may know of such land in the New River Valley, we'd love to hear from you.
And let me just ask here, if there is somebody listening who would like to get in touch, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, there are several options. One would be by email, which could be through the address sojourncenter@gmail.com. I certainly would be happy to receive a personal call. This is Ann Campbell, and my number is 951-8326 on behalf of the board. The other area we're working on besides land is planning for a building, and we had an architect selection committee that worked very hard, and we've selected an architect, and now we're moving into a building committee that will work with the architects in terms of programming, what's called programming, which I've learned is helping the architects see what function, all the functions that will come to the building, and therefore planning for that in design work.
As part of a planning process, we are writing a so-called strategic plan, and one of the categories there would be what are the advantages Sojourn Center has in accomplishing it and moving toward its goals, and what are the challenges? Some people talk about strengths and weaknesses, but the language of weakness and limitation is not part of my vocabulary. And obviously, one of the major challenges is funding the building, the program. So recently, we've begun talking with some professional fundraising firms to get some sense of what would be entailed in raising the money. We've talked with them specifically about a study which would help us understand our capacity and also help us understand, you know, where the dollars are. And that's a major step, and we still have a lot to do in regard to a capital campaign or a study preceding the campaign to tell us what's possible.
How much, I'm sure folks listening in will say, well, how much money do they want to raise? What do they need? I'm ready to pull out my checkbook.
Great. Pull out that checkbook.
Well, one of the fundraisers we talked to, we gave him the sum of what had been projected and then for various reasons, inflation over a few years and so on, we've hit on the sum, ideally, of $2.5 to $3 million over a period of time, but a short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that total amount of money up front would not only allow us to build a residential facility and do some of the landscaping, but it would also help fund operations as we're starting up.
Exactly.
So we want it to be secure from the very start. Community-based hospice houses are supported by communities, and we know that many donations come in to help continue hospice houses over time. So that will eventually be part of our funding, but we need the kickstart now to get things going.
Great. And we'll come back in just a moment and talk about what folks specifically can do to help out to get Sojourn Center down the road a bit. We'll be back after this short break. This is Borderline by Alison Krauss from her album Lonely Runs Both Ways. Back. You're listening to Talk at the Table. We're here with our guests from the Sojourn Center, and we in the last quarter hour, we're talking about some of the work that has gone on at the Sojourn Center, some of the activities. And I don't think we quite finished that, that there are programs and other activities that are being implemented right now by Sojourn Center.
The educational function of Sojourn Center is very important to us. So one of our goals was to get out into the community and start doing education around hospice. What is hospice? What are hospice services? And what's palliative medicine, which is the new subspecialty in medicine that really focuses on supporting people that aren't curable, but who we can improve their quality of life and their comfort. So we've given at least 11 presentations out in the community to different groups, including Virginia Tech classes, and have engaged in quite a few Virginia Tech students in helping already with this project, grant writing, etc. So I would encourage people, if they would like a presentation by our group on any related topic, to go through the Sojourn Center at gmail.com to let us know.
Right, and then the number 951-8326.
Yes.
And the email address, sojourncenter, all one word, at gmail.com. In this last quarter hour, the last few minutes that we have, share with us what some of the next steps for Sojourn Center are going to be. You just finished a real comprehensive planning session, and particularly focus on the volunteer opportunities. It looks to me like, or it sounds as though, there are going to be a number of great opportunities for folks to get involved in some way.
That's right, Andy. I think, first of all, the Sojourn Center group that is functioning now is entirely volunteer. We have no paid staff at all. We just have people with a lot of passion for a wonderful cause. We have had some wonderful support. I want to mention, as Tina did, that through associations with both faculty and students at Virginia Tech. We have three members on our board of either advisors or directors that are in the business school at Tech, and they have given us immense wisdom and guidance in moving along to where we are. In visiting the different hospice houses that we have, almost all of them have mentioned a strong volunteer team that helps them function. And very commonly, they're bringing up the number of between 100 and 200 volunteers from the community at each one of these hospice houses. And as I mentioned before, those people may be doing administrative assistance, but very often they're doing resident-oriented volunteering. There's a lot of volunteering that's done to save some of the costs, such as people doing landscaping, gardening. We see a great potential for young people to get involved as well. Most of the hospice houses have either a room for children's play or an outside playground that some of their teen service volunteers have been a part of establishing. It's a wonderful opportunity for our community to get involved to help one another in this way.
Currently, we need some very simple things. If we had somebody that helps us write our thank you notes at this point, that would relieve some of us of that task. We also find ourselves thinking, well, we need somebody that is very good at computers, setting up computer systems, because we'll be setting up our office soon. So there are some very applied, simple things that a volunteer could do at this point and be very useful to us.
We are also really interested if there are either active or retired business people who have business experience that would like to come and join us, because there certainly are business-related decisions that are being made, and we would love to have some more advisors and potential board members with business backgrounds join in our passion.
This is a really a great group of folks. I've had some opportunity to be involved with your group and have been impressed by the quality of the folks that you have attracted. You have some leading faculty folks from Virginia Tech, attorneys and business people from the local community, folks who have a lot of experience in the nonprofit sector as well. So it's a wonderful group. And what seems to me, and maybe I should see if this is actually the case, it looks like a group that really gets along well with each other. There's a lot of mutual respect and willingness to work collaboratively with each other. And there's no single dominant personality, that it really does feel like a community of intention that has gathered around Sojourn Center.
I think we've really have done decision making pretty much by consensus to this point. We don't have any figureheads, and it has been just a wonderful group to work with, and a very much a friend maker for me personally, too.
I want to thank the three of you, Ann Campbell, Fred Carlisle, and Tina Smuz, for joining us this afternoon to share with our listening audience and the broader community about hospice care and about Sojourn Center, a new initiative that is taking shape in our community to develop a hospice house here in the New River Valley. You've been listening to Talk at the Table. I'm your host, Andy Morikawa. We're here every Sunday from 2:30 to 3:30 talking about community and hearing from folks in our community who are engaged in the life of developing ours as a community that is inclusive of all who live here. Also, become our fan on Facebook, join our listener community, receive updates, check us out at Facebook.com/talk at the table. Until next week, keep talking community.
Yes, that is rebroadcasted Talk at the Table from May 2011. If you are interested in community service, Habitat for Humanity NRV is the place for you. We have volunteer opportunities, including swinging hammers, retail sales, and office support. There is something for everyone when helping others step out of poverty. A team building event is being held on November the 10th and 11th in Blacksburg. Please visit www.habitatnrv.org or call 540-731-8660. For more information, got news coming up in about 10 minutes here. Got a couple more tracks to play until that time. So coming up first, this is some Cactus.
said,
I'm
You're listening to WUVT FM 90.7 Blacksburg. We're now kicking off with Tech Talk. I'm Lauren Hickman.
I'm Dan Goff.
And I'm Ryan Durham.
And I'm James Morrow.
All right. As you know, in our show, we discuss our favorite news topics of the week and go into a little bit of a discussion about them. After a break, we give you a weather update and then dive right back into the news discussion. So before we get on our main topic today, Dan wanted to bring up the Red Bull. What is it? Stratos?
Stratos, yes.
That guy was, that was sick.
It was.
Yeah, it's been blowing up Twitter.
Awesome.
That was. It's a big day for science, and it's not just a big day for space, and it's not just a big day for atmospheric
science.
Record
breaking.
Yeah, and it's a big day for him, and he deserves all the credit that he's going to get, and so does his team. But this is a big day for science, and I think we're going to see some of the rewards from what he did today for a long time to come.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know when the prior record was set before him?
1960.
Yeah, that's what I read it was in the 1960s. Was it confirmed that he actually broke the sound barrier?
I think it was unconfirmed. I don't think they've got the data crunched just yet to know for sure whether or not he broke the sound barrier.
But it definitely showed that he went into the 700 mile per hour.
Yeah,
area.
He definitely broke 700 miles an hour.
He broke 3 out of the 4 records that were at stake.
Yep.
Officially. The fourth one is the sound barrier.
So he broke the record for highest manned balloon flight, highest free fall, and what was the third one?
Was it just speed in general, aside from the sound barrier breakage?
The record he did not break was for longest free fall in terms of time. He fell about 15 seconds short of that. But Captain Kittinger back in 1960 set that record. I think it was 4 minutes 36 seconds. And he was in free fall for about 4:20 before he deployed his chute.
Wow. That's really fast. And it said he was about 24 miles up, correct?
Yeah, it was 127,000 plus feet when he finally jumped.
That's crazy. I don't know if I could ever even comprehend trying to do something like that.
Even the most extreme base jumpers.
Yeah, that was...
Because they usually free fall about a mile at tops, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, they're falling for a long time. It's from a big height, but it's not nearly...
You can only jump for about 20,000 feet from about an altitude of 20,000 feet without needing oxygen. So once you get above that, it gets a lot more technical and a lot more complex.
Right, which is why he needed the space suit for the jump.
Yeah, I mean, at the point where he jumped, there was virtually no atmosphere. There was only a very little semblance of an atmosphere left. The pressure there was about 1 millibar. Compared to the surface here, the average surface pressure is about 1,013 millibars. Mm. Basically, there was almost nothing up there.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
One of the biggest accomplishments is he survived. So
And there were a couple harrowing moments there when he first entered freefall. He was spinning and twisting and tumbling and turning around, and I was a little worried he wasn't going to come out of that. But you could see as he got lower and he got into the atmosphere where he actually had some resistance against the air, he was able to keep things under control.
Right. What we were saying about his age, he's in his 40s. I think even at 21 years old, literally have a heart attack.
No, absolutely not.
Well, I
wouldn't survive.
You have to train yourself extremely hard and in a very specific regimen. And I know I've read up on some amazing feats that humans have done. One of them was deep diving, which is basically the same thing that this guy did, in the sense that I'm going to go under the assumption that part of his regimen was he shut his body down, so to speak, so that his body could reserve the oxygen and reserve the energy to make up for the lack of atmosphere. And when he went into free fall, so that when his body had all of the necessary ingredients to function, his body would still be going okay.
He had oxygen in his suit. He had about a 10-minute supply when he jumped. So he had enough to get back down.
Yeah, and these extreme divers I was talking about, they dive extremely, extremely low with some emergency oxygen, too. But they're going, 10, 15 miles deep into the water. Well, maybe not that far.
No.
I'm exaggerating.
That's about the extent.
They're going right up. They're testing the limits of how much pressure the water puts on the body, I guess is the point I'm trying to make. And going extremely, extremely deep.
And that's about that. That's the big difference is that when you go up in the atmosphere, you come very, very close to a perfect vacuum. And as you head down in the water, it's the exact opposite. You keep adding the weight of the water on, and it increases pretty quickly.
So what do you think you guys would preferably do? Do you like the deep diving underwater with the pressure building on you, or go and free fall the jump?
I would rather keep my both feet on land.
I like the earth.
Flying is fun. I would prefer to both leave land and return to land in the same vehicle as opposed to jumping out of an airplane.
Your body being the vehicle.
Yeah.
And there is a big difference between, you know, a 10-minute free fall and a 10-hour dive, because there is a difference. You can't come up all in once, or otherwise you're not going to survive that. There's other complications.
The pressure changes going underwater are much greater than even a 100,000-foot jump in the atmosphere.
Definitely.
I think that's one of the things I'm most impressed about was the amount of time in which he fell far of distance. Like, it's just...
And the second he stepped out, it took Noah more than about 30 seconds for him to reach 700 miles an hour.
Incredible.
Yeah.
So scary. All right. So we just wanted to mention that since it happened like an hour ago. Relevant to get to you quick. We'll have more information on it probably in the broadcast tomorrow. More of the official data that they come up with. So we'll get into the main topic of today, which is where it is the return of the April 16th cases. Two appeals are going on right now. We talked about it in Thursday's news, and that's going to be our topic for today. I'll give you a little bit of information just in case you're unfamiliar with the topic. The first appeal is by the state of Virginia, whose ruling in June found it negligent by a jury and judge with the April 16th shootings here at Virginia Tech. The jury originally awarded the parents who made the case against them $4 million, charged the state $4 million per family, but the state law knocked it down to $100,000. The state is appealing this decision to the Virginia Supreme Court, arguing that the university is more at fault and not the actual state. The other appeal that's currently simultaneously going on and is going to the Virginia Supreme Court is an appeal by the parents of the two April 16th victims, Julia Pride and Aaron Peterson. In the same ongoing trial earlier, Steger and other Tech officials were dismissed of charges brought on by the parents for failing to warn their daughters of the danger presented by Sung Hui Cho. The parents are now appealing to the Virginia Supreme Court as well to try to have the ruling overturned. So I know we've talked about this before. I think the first time this court case appeared was in 2010, I believe. So we've obviously talked about it before. But let's just state again our stances as to who is responsible, who we think is responsible for the shootings in Norris Hall. Obviously, the West AJ shootings could not have been conceived at first, but there is debate as to whether the Norris Hall shootings could have been prevented or at least lessened. So do you think it's the police's fault, particularly Tech Police Chief Flincham, the university, and therefore President Steger and other officials? Are they at fault? Is the state at fault? Or is no one really to blame and this is simply a tragic string of events? And we can consider the Cleary Act in this, and that the fact that the university rules state as protocol for an event such as April 16th shootings. So what do you guys think? Who is at fault?
I'm going to jump in here because nobody else is.
I was going to answer my question first if nobody else.
Well, ladies first. Go right ahead.
All right. I will set the stage. Going by what we know from the Cleary Act case, that in the school policies, the university police is responsible for notifying the public of a tragic event such as this, of an emergency event such as the April 16th shootings. So I believe that it wasn't necessarily Steger and university officials, but actually the Virginia Tech police which I guess is in essence an official of Virginia Tech, so to speak. But I don't think it was Steger who was responsible. I think it was more the police chief, because he actually gave instructions to Steger, according to what they've stated in court thus far as to making their argument, that Flincham asked Steger for the university emergency response people to send out the email instead of the police, as the policies of Virginia Tech had stated, and to also not be specific as to what actually happened in West AJ in the email to the students and staff of the university. So that's my opinion, is that they're going after the wrong people.
Read straight from the lawyer of Virginia Tech, and in the case of dismissing Steger as a defendant in this case. That's what you just said, Lauren. Basically,
well, and according to the state attorney's argument for the
right.
state's case, it's saying
You read it straight from there. The fact of the matter,
but it makes sense though.
Well, as far as who's set up to be culpable for it, yes. But whose policy was it to have the Virginia Tech police be the? Because I believe we talked about this when the Cleary Act case got brought back up. Wasn't this Virginia Tech's policy to have the university police be the notifiers of what goes on campus at this point? That the university came up with that, right?
Yeah, so it's not
the university's policy? Isn't that part of Steger's policy? Isn't that part of Steger's responsibility as president and overseer of the whole university?
Right.
Yeah, so this is a fault of their plan. So they are somewhat culpable. And I've said this from the beginning. Virginia Tech, the university, and everybody they did the best they could given the plan that they had, but their plan was flawed to begin with. And it's an unspeakable tragedy, but this is why Virginia Tech is losing so many of its cases, because it was a faulty plan, and it was not set up to deal with there's a tragedy that was able to find loopholes and problems with their response system, and this is why they have gone back and they have completely revamped it, and we saw what it did with the Officer Crouch shooting and how effective it was. But that was a direct result of this tragedy. So everybody is at fault when it comes to notifying the public. And I've said from the beginning, the only way that Virginia Tech as a university is officially just going to move on from this tragedy is they need to just say, we are responsible partially for what happened on April 16th. We have proven that we have taken necessary steps to ever prevent something like this from happening again, which they have. And, swallow their pride, lose the litigation. And it's just, it is what it is. They don't have a case. This is their policy. It is their responsibility. And they don't have a legal case.
But my point I'm making is, yes, Steger should have been aware of the rules, and he most likely was at the incident, but he was told by the Virginia Tech police chief that, hey, you need to take care of this, because obviously we can't, for whatever reason, even though they should have had a PR person that should have been able to notify the public, that's specifically their job, because we've gotten emails prior to this of people, that one girl who was attacked outside of her car and brought to several ATMs around the area. We've been notified of stuff like that before, so why couldn't they do it then? You can't make the argument that, oh, you know, this is such a big case that we need everyone on staff to...
That's not the case I'm making, Lauren. What I'm saying is...
No, I know,
This is Virginia Tech's policy. That's the point I'm trying to make, and therefore it's their policy. They have to brunt the consequences of their policy the way their infrastructure is set up.
Right, but what are you supposed to do when the person in charge of sending out that email says, hey, we can't do it, we need you to do it?
It's a fault in the plan, like I said. This is why everybody is culpable. Everybody is.
I agree that Steger
Everybody is culpable of it. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that this is all on Steger. I'm not saying this is all on the Virginia Tech staff. What I'm saying is it's their policy, and they bore the consequences of their policy when a party that they are not directly responsible for is in charge of something, and they're, for whatever reason, are unable to do it. That is a consequence of relying on second and third parties to do something. And this is what happened. It is, and this is the consequence of their policy. It just is. So they are partially responsible for this.
I'll agree with you when you said the policy was not at all prepared for this incident, because I don't think anyone's policy would have been prepared for the caliber of this incident, and this massacre, this tragedy that occurred here. And the one big thing that I see is, yes, I agree. I think Tech did things that they shouldn't have done. Now, the one thing I do see is if it had been just the shooting in West AJ at that time, I think Tech's policy was prepared for that. And they followed the proper procedure for that at that time. The problem is no one saw the 30 in Norsall shooting, the 30 people that died and 10, 12 more that were injured. No one saw that coming, and that's really where the policy took a hit. We were prepared for a certain amount, but I don't think anyone was prepared for that second.
And I understand then, and I agree. I agree with the merit of it. Well, all I'm saying is when you are the responsible party and something like this happens to you, it's on you, whether it's fair or not, whether it's completely 100% justifiable or not, it still is on you. And you have to, it is your policy, and you have to bear the consequences of it legally, morally, you know, whatever the case may be. That's all I'm saying. And this is the situation that they're in.
But, sorry.
No, okay.
Actually, we should take a break because it is time to take a break. So we will be right back with the weather, and then we'll continue out this conversation after that.
This is boot camp. This is the real thing now. You've never done anything so hard in your life. You don't understand how you can finish. It takes inner strength and desire to become a Marine. When I finished, I was like, I did it. The moment I will never forget is when this drill instructor that I admire so much comes up to me and said, "Good morning, Marine."
PFC Summer Volkman became a Marine. Can you? Visit Marines.com or call 1-800-MARINES.
All right, we're back with Tech Talk, and we're going to go into our weather segment. James, you got it covered for us today, don't you?
I do, and after the last 2 days, especially with homecoming game yesterday and today's beautiful weather, I have a feeling that I won't be able to be as optimistic for the rest of the week, especially on Monday. But
yes, the pressure's off me this week.
you get blamed for all the bad weather now. like I said, homecoming yesterday when finally Tech decided to start their offense, you know, into the second quarter. They waited a quarter before, you know, give us
Thank
all heart
God.
Attacks. Game time weather was 60 degrees and sunny. I mean, you can't beat that, especially for a autumn day like yesterday.
How about 70 degrees and sunny?
Oh, well, I guess, yes.
Oh, yeah, there we go.
You didn't prove me wrong, because today, I tell you what, it was well above normal, you know, right at 70 degrees. I think we're just getting there now. So if you're listening to us inside, I would recommend taking a radio outside, because 70 degrees, mostly sunny skies. There are a few clouds out there, but they're on upper deck clouds, so they're not affecting the temperature at all. So
wouldn't it be so fun if we could bring our broadcast outside, just broadcast?
Something
live remote?
Oh, yeah.
What?
We'll have to work on that for a few weeks from now, especially next spring. But, yeah.
The producer's giving us dirty looks.
Unfortunately, we won't be able to hang this around for long. As we move in tonight, we have a cold front that's going to be approaching from our west southwest, and that'll be bringing some clouds and precip. Precip should be moving in about just in time for the rush to work tomorrow morning, so just in time for us to wake up, unfortunately.
Excellent.
Yeah, but don't fret. We will be done by, hopefully, the rush hour. I mean, I have a few little lingering clouds, but other than that, it should be an overall pretty nice day, high in the mid-60s, you know, maybe a little less if the precip hangs around a little bit.
That's not too bad.
A little bit longer, but, and tonight's going to be also beautiful, 50s, which is, you know, Summertime, not so much, but for autumn weather, you can't beat that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and this cold front that will be moving in, it is the one associated with some of the severe weather we've been seeing, including a few tornadoes out west. But don't fear, we're not going to be getting any severe weather with this. We might hear a rumble of thunder, but I seriously doubt it if I had to put my prediction out there, which I'm doing right now, I guess. The rest of the week, though, after tomorrow evening, you know, things should start clearing out. It might be a little slow, but I would say by Tuesday morning for sure, we might be good to go with high in the 60s and lows in the lower 40s for the rest of the week, which is typical weather for this time of year. Maybe a little bit warmer on the warmer side, so can't complain too much about that.
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely not. Do we know, quick question, if this is supposed to be more of a mild winter or...
I don't think NOAA's come out with their winter seasonal forecast yet. One of the big questions is going to be whether or not we see an El Nino develop. El Nino was one of the factors influencing the big winter we had back in 2009, 2010 with
right.
the Snowmageddon and the Snowpocalypse, and then Snowmageddon 2, Snowpoboogaloo. I think I've used that line before, so sorry. But right now, it's been a very, very marginal, neutral is probably a better word there, very neutral sea surface temperature conditions in the Central Pacific. So there's some question as to whether or not we're actually going to see an El Nino. If we don't, then we may see a little more moderate winter than we might have otherwise. We will probably see a little less snow than we would likely see in an El Nino winter, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, I would be totally okay with a repeat of last winter. Last winter was pretty mild. I enjoyed it. No, not really any snow.
You didn't have to come in and work the snow show?
I didn't, because I was sick.
Oh, yeah, that was about this time last year, and we were battling flurries and 30s at this time, so
yeah.
I don't know.
We had an early October snow scare last year, and I'm glad not a whole lot came out of that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm set, though, guys. I got my flu shot yesterday. It should be good for the rest of the season. Hooray.
Hooray.
All right. So we'll go back into our discussion about the two appeals going on for the April 16th shootings. My one point I wanted to make also, if I may, for the last question about the stances that to who is at fault for April 16th. Another reason why I put the blame more on the police chief and Virginia Tech police is because along with asking Steger to have this university group send out the email, he also specified to not put the specifics of what happened in West AJ in the email, to not have the public understand the degree to which a violent event occurred. And I think this is what Tech has gotten most in trouble with these cases, is the fact that, first of all, that they delayed their warning so long, and also they didn't describe to which degree the first shootings occurred, and thus the public was not aware of the gravity, I guess.
That's a good word. The other thing that we've seen, and not just here in Blacksburg, but around the country with various situations, is the transparency goes a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And the communications that came out, especially early in the day of that day, were anything but transparent.
Yeah.
There was a lot of trying to hide. Necessarily, I don't know if it was intentional or not. It sounds like it was. They at least had some reasons for whatever reason that was, that they wanted to... I'm trying to find the right word.
Only reason I can think of is pretty much the same reason why most organizations, individuals, what have you, do this.
They don't want
to
cause panic.
It's PR. No, yeah. It's not necessarily panic. It's PR. It's good PR, or not good PR. It's they want to avoid the ongoing storm eventual, or try to lower it as much as possible.
They want to control the message.
Exactly. They want to control the message, and they want to, you know, they don't want everybody saying, oh my God, a huge shooting occurred at Virginia Tech. What happened? What they're trying to say is a crime committed at Virginia Tech. We'll have more details later. You know, it's one big PR stunt. It's all it is.
I just don't think that they can, with understanding, I mean, it's always easier to say in retrospect we should have done this or whatever, but their argument, I understand not wanting to cause a panic, and that's a lot of the reason why forces such as this are more discreet in the original acts of what happened because they don't want to cause the panic. But to make the assumption, we talked about this before, that it was limited to that domestic event that they called the original West AJ shootings was just...
That was a horrible assumption.
Nonsensical. I mean, you take the factor, somebody who willingly kills someone else is obviously mentally unstable. And to believe that when you don't have them in custody, that, oh, it'll be fine, it's limited to this one event, is completely nuts to me. Like, honestly, like, whether in retrospect or beforehand, you should know that someone who's willing to kill someone else and is still on the loose is not a safe thing. You can't just say, we're in safe territory now.
Thinking about what they knew at the time, which was, at the very least, hey, somebody came into West AJ, murdered two people. We don't know who it is. We don't know why they did it. We don't know what could happen next. To say, hey, this is, you know, the only thing that's going to happen, let's just work on finding this person and then dealing with it, is probably, and I'm trying to find the right way to phrase this, if I were talking about weather, I would say, hey, here's the situation, and based on the climatology, based on what's happened in the past, and based on what we know, this is maybe likely an isolated incident.
Right.
You know, your first thought maybe, unless you're of that mind, is to not necessarily say, hey, I've got somebody who's murdered two people now. I don't know what's going on, but do I need to worry that they're going to go, you know, murder 30 more and injure many beyond that?
Yeah, didn't it seem pretty targeted? I mean, you enter into this huge dorm and you go into one room.
Oh, yeah, it was targeted. Room,
I mean, it was nothing, originally, you know? Targeted,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Cho had a personal relationship with at least one of the two people.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, when you see that, and it's targeted, you don't expect, you know, that's what I think where they got the domestic idea out. You know, someone went into a specific room, you know, incident happened, and then they left. Nothing else. Not like, you know, someone on the way out got, you know, shot too or something to that nature. You know, and I don't think anybody saw what happened in Norris Hall coming.
I mean, I don't think you would ever anticipate the amount of people that he shot. But you can't just say that nothing else is going to happen when somebody had the depravity to, I don't think there's Toon Talk today, so...
Oh, okay, if we're going to...
We're not, really.
That, all right, that's fine.
There's not Toon Talk today, right, Ian? No, okay, so we might go a little bit over, sorry. But, I mean, you can't just... I just can't... Knowing... I'm a psychology minor, and just knowing how... Understanding mental instability... You have to be, something has to be wrong with you mentally to be able to murder a human being, no matter if it's an act of passion or whatever people plead in court that this is the reason why they murdered someone. It doesn't matter. There's something mentally wrong with you.
People, even at their most rational, are unpredictable. And that's kind of really what it boils down to. It is... You know, there's enough entropy in the system when people are doing things rationally and are making rational actions and rational decisions. You can't always figure exactly what they're going to do.
Yeah.
When you toss in that much entropy into a system,
yeah.
when you make it that unstable, and when you take a person that was unstable as he was, and again, even looking at their perspective and assuming that they didn't know who it was
right
at that point, I think that just increases the uncertainty, increases the range of probabilities, a range of possibilities that you have to consider.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you're charged with, and I think this has been part of the argument, is whether or not the university is responsible for providing a safe community. And I think that absolutely they are.
Yeah, absolutely.
If they weren't, then they wouldn't have their own police force.
Right.
At the very least. But, you know, when you're charged with protecting the lives and livelihoods of 30,000 people, you have to consider as many possibilities as possible. And
agreed.
There are obviously lines when it comes to talking about the Constitution and what we're allowed to do and what we're not. But considering those possibilities, at least to the extent that they can, it should be their first mission.
Yeah. All right. So we'll move on to the next questions. We're going to look at the appeals individually. So do you guys think that the state has a valid argument for its appeal, which they, as I said before,